This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Senator Rand Paul was called out by Rachel Maddow on MSNBC recently for lifting words to the plot of the movie Gattaca from Wikipedia in a speech he gave. Then BuzzFeed found he did the same thing with the movie Stand and Deliver in another speech and cribbed parts of a Heritage Foundation study in a book. Paul didn't exactly apologize, but did admit to sloppiness and improper footnoting. He now joins a group of other well-known people who have been caught and or accused of plagiarizing: Joe Biden, Jane Goodale, Fareed Zakaria, Doris Kearns Goodwin. It's a pretty long list. So how common is plagiarism and how serious a problem? We have two guests. Kelly McBride is senior faculty in ethics reporting and writing at the Poynter Institute, joins us from their ISDN studio. And Kelly, nice to have you with us back on Radio Times.
Yeah, thanks.
Also with us is Susan Bloom, and she's a cultural and linguistic anthropologist, also professor of anthropology at the University of Notre Dame, author of a book called My Work, Plagiarism in College Culture. And Susan Bloom, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Kelly, let me begin with you and begin with Rand Paul. Do you see that as cold-blooded plagiarism, what he did?
Yeah, in the most minor sense. You know, there were certain phrases that were picked up that were virtually identical. It's a very common form of plagiarism, and I'm not saying that it's acceptable at all because professors are trying to beat this out of students all over the world. But it happens quite often, and it's really a sign of intellectual laziness.
Mm. But I think it also speaks to, and perhaps this is more political people or people in public, which is oftentimes they don't write their own speeches. Someone else is doing this. So the vetting process can get complicated.
Well, yeah. I mean, it happens both ways. Sometimes I've looked at a couple of examples of plagiarism with a politician where the politician actually did write the speech, and then sometimes it's staffers. But either way, if you're putting something out into the public that you are saying is your own thoughts or your staff's own thoughts, then you do have an obligation to make those your own thoughts and your own words, not to crib from other sources. And that doesn't mean that you don't do research, but it means that in the intellectual rigor of crafting the message, you really use your own words.
Mm. Susan, let me go to you and what Rand Paul said in response to these charges. He says, "I will now footnote everything just like in college." And it seemed a bit of a put down of college. What do you make of his, admission?
Yeah, his misdeed, of course, as Kelly said, is very common, especially for people who are expected to produce things constantly. But his response was particularly noteworthy because he made it clear he is standing on the side of all those students who suffered at the hands of their mean teachers, and he is going to comply, but only grudgingly, and he's going to exaggerate his compliance by footnoting everything, which, of course, we know we can't do and shouldn't, in fact, do. So he's trying to show that he's not going to be on the side of the creative producers of intellectual property.
Does he sound like one of your students, Susan?
Not my students. He sounds like some students that I've read about.
Well, I was thinking about Wikipedia, and I mean, I use Wikipedia sometimes when I want to triple check something. I try not to quote from it because we know that it's written, in a sense, by committee. But I wonder, Kelly, by using Wikipedia, does that put it in a gray area at all?
No. Okay. I mean, Wikipedia isn't any excuse. And you know, the real problem with Wikipedia is a lot of the stuff that's on Wikipedia is actually cribbed from other sources, often word for word. And so I know from talking to people who work at Wikipedia that they're trying to figure out a graceful way to tackle this problem. Right. But Wikipedia has a fair amount of plagiarism on it.
Well, and so just how common do we think plagiarism is, Susan, from your perspective?
It depends what you mean by plagiarism, and we'll hear later from Alan Brown about people who plagiarize inadvertently. As somebody who studies language, I know, and it's a kind of truism, that everything we say is in part put together by using bits and pieces of things we've heard before. I just said bits and pieces. I didn't create that phrase.
Right.
But there is a clear No, there is a blurry line between what we need to cite and what we don't have to cite. And, of course, if I'm being a poetic and I want to use a phrase from a poem and I'm going to use literary allusion, that's considered acceptable and even appropriate. But if I'm going to take a piece of something written recently that has a name and take whole chunks of it and import it knowingly into my own words, then that is considered plagiarism, and that is common. Students do it to varying degrees. If you look at surveys, students admit that they've plagiarized in either 60% or 80% of the cases, but wow. They don't necessarily mean that they've imported whole chunks. They might mean that they feel guilty about having used a phrase that they didn't footnote, and so they will admit on a survey that they have committed plagiarism. But the kind of thing that we've seen in this case with Mr. Paul right. is probably not nearly as common as the news media make us think it is.
Well, that's interesting. And I wonder from your perspective, Kelly, whether it's, you know, using 4 words? Is it using 7 words? Is it lifting a whole sentence? Is it more someone's ideas and their words? Is that how you define plagiarism?
Well, so this is really interesting because I talk to a lot of editors who are trying to figure out, like, what's legal,
right?
And like, so if you want to have that conversation, which I actually find to be a more boring conversation to have, but let's spend a little bit of time
okay,
on it.
Let's be boring for at least a bit. Okay.
Well, so I talk about between 7 and 12 words. Okay. Like, it is virtually impossible to copy word for word more than somewhere between 7 and 12 words unless you are intentionally doing it. And so a lot of times what you see with students, with writers who are producing a lot of copy very quickly is they are using these other sources and they don't want to slow down and figure out they don't really want to synthesize, and so they just pick up the phrase or the sentence or the paragraph and throw it into their own work. And sometimes they tell themselves, oh, I'll go back and I'll fix this later, and sometimes they have no intention of telling themselves that. But what I think is more important is to talk about the intention of the writer. Because often when I talk to writers who intended to create something mm-hmm. unique, mm-hmm. you see that number of words getting smaller and smaller. But when you talk to a writer who really doesn't care about intellectual honesty, who really doesn't care about original thought, you see the number of words getting greater and greater. And I think that's what professors and editors and people who are trying to create a creative marketplace of ideas are all interested in, is what we want are original thoughts. And that is really, I think, the difference between a minor plagiarist that I probably wouldn't be concerned about and someone that I would be concerned about is their intention. Do they really understand what originality and intellectual honesty are? Or are there working circumstances such that they just that they don't even have the time to care about that?
Well, and I'm wondering from a student perspective or even a college or university perspective, Susan, and you talk about the high amount of plagiarism, is that students think they can get away with it, or they just don't understand that they are, in a sense, taking someone else's ideas or words for their own, that it's a kind of a theft?
There's a range of reasons. Some don't understand. They really haven't gotten it, and that's especially true of international students who have grown up in a situation with different norms of intellectual property. Some students do think they can get away with it, and don't listen to me, students out there, but they are in some sense right. If students are plagiarizing at numbers approaching 60%, and most universities actually prosecute students in the dozens, most students, in fact, are getting away with it, partly because faculty are over extended. They have high workloads, and they often can't be bothered, especially in fields other than, let's say, English, to pursue such suspicions. But the question of intellectual property is something that really matters to professional writers, to people who make a living as journalists, as novelists, as screenwriters, and they understand that it's a matter of, in some ways, life or death, their livelihood, to be given credit for their original productions. As Kelly said, students often don't imagine themselves in that situation.
You know, can I add to that?
Yeah, go ahead, Kelly.
Because the other thing, and I've noticed this, I have three teenagers. I've done a lot of volunteering in middle schools and high schools, and of course I work with college students all the time. And there is this deficit in our education system, and I think it starts around middle school, where we really don't teach kids what to do instead of plagiarize.
Hmm.
And sometimes it's because we require that kids work with material that is beyond their cognitive development, and sometimes it's because we really don't sit down with them and write side by side with them. So we send them home to write, and we ask them to do a science project or whatever, and they're dealing with, you know, vocabulary and material that's just beyond their capabilities, and so they don't know how to do, they never develop the skill to do something other than plagiarize. That's a big problem, and it's easily remedied. You just have to teach them what to do.
Mm. But and this is not to say anything about you, Kelly, as a parent, but we also know that there are parents who will, in a sense, do their children's homework for them, or write their essays for them, or their essays to get into college for them.
Well, and some of those, I mean, some of those parents don't know the difference either, mm-hmm. too. I mean, this isn't a new problem. I think this has been common in our education system for a long time.
Well, and Susan, about a minute before our first break here, but I mean, it seems that the internet offers the possibility of plagiarism, but it also offers a way to catch people who do plagiarize as well.
The ease of catching student plagiarism has increased greatly. I remember going to libraries 30 years ago and trying to track down the sources of students' work, but now I have the internet just as they do, and if I have a suspicion that there's plagiarism, I can find it pretty quickly.
Well, let's take that short break. We are talking about plagiarism in this hour of Radio Times, and we want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You can also send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times or at Marty Moss Cohen. And you can also send us an email. We're full service here at WHYY.org. Talking with Kelly McBride, Senior Faculty in Ethics, Reporting, and Writing at the Poynter Institute. And Susan Bloom, she's a cultural and linguistic anthropologist at the University of Notre Dame, author of a book that came out just a few years ago called My Word, Plagiarism and College Culture. And we have Alan Brown waiting in the wings. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
International House Philadelphia supports WHYY, an independent nonprofit dedicated to advancing cultural dialogue. International House presents the film series Birdwatching, a celluloid salute to our feathered friends, running from November 20th through the 23rd, with a special 50th anniversary screening of Hitchcock's classic thriller The Birds on Friday, November 22nd. Tickets and information at 215-387-5125 or at ihousephilly.org.
Next time in Studio 360...
Wiley, sir, please talk to me, please!
It's not just another terrible movie. It's the Citizen Kane of terrible movies.
You don't understand anything, man. Leave your stupid comments in your pocket.
The strange but true story of The Room. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, in his new memoir, The Death of Santini, best-selling author Pat Conroy mines his powerful family history yet again.
No writer has been imprisoned by his family like I have in the history of American letters. I have been writing about this family for 40 years.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain, talking with Susan Bloom and Kelly McBride about plagiarism. And joining us now is Alan Brown. He's a professor of psychology at Southern Methodist University. He studies memory problems and joins us to talk a bit about, I guess, what we might call accidental plagiarism. There's a fancy word for that. What is that, Alan Brown?
That's cryptomnesia.
Cryptomnesia. And what does that mean?
Well, amnesia, like we've heard the word amnesia, which means a, which is the lack of amnesia, which is memory.
Right.
And crypto means new. So crypto with amnesia means that it's a memory that seems new, but it's something that you're actually digging out of your memory that you think is new, but it's actually old.
So we're talking about what?
Did that make sense?
It did, but let's flesh it out just a little bit.
Okay.
So I guess a kind of inadvertent plagiarism, is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, it's been called inadvertent plagiarism or unconscious plagiarism. It's sort of the entity to blame is your unconscious. Mm-hmm. It's in your memory, but you're not consciously aware of it. So you pull out this information, and you think it's new, but it's actually something that was planted there earlier, something that you read or heard, or got from some other source that you now think is something original to you, but it's actually something that's old.
So is it our memories playing a trick on us?
Well, it's not really a trick. Whenever we learn something new or hear some information, there's actually two parts of the information. One is the actual content of what we're hearing, like a fact or somebody's idea. And the other thing is where we've heard it or, the situation, the context. That I heard this from a certain person in a certain media or in a certain time. And sometimes that peripheral information, which we call source information, evaporates more quickly than the fact information. So what we're left with is a piece of information in our brain that doesn't have these little tags that should alert us to the fact that this is actually something that's old or somebody else's idea or you heard it someplace else. That tends to fade very quickly.
And I do want to get our other two guests back in on the conversation, but do you think, Alan Brown, this explains why there is, at least in part, so much plagiarism?
There's a lot, especially people that are engaged in information dissemination. There is a lot of opportunities for these people to hear things or read things that they try to transmit to others, let's say speechwriters. Earlier you were discussing Rand Paul, and I don't want to be an apologist, but if someone is in a hurry to construct speeches or phrases or commentaries on certain subjects, they may read a lot of material. That material gets absorbed into their memory, and then when they go to what they think spontaneously write about it, they're actually drawing from these bits and pieces that other people have said, and they fail to acknowledge or remember that they have heard these or gathered these from another source.
Well, Kelly McBride, does that make sense to you?
Yeah, although I'd wonder what the limitations of that are. Right. Like, is there a limit to how much we can actually accidentally misremember?
The idea is maybe you would misremember a phrase, but would you misremember
a whole paragraph?
A whole paragraph, for instance. Alan?
Well, that's a very good point. I mean, some people have been accused of plagiarizing large segments of information, and they blame their very excellent memory on this problem, which, it's hard to tell whether that's really the case. There's a classic case with George Harrison plagiarizing a song from the Chiffons. He wrote My Sweet Lord, and the Chiffons sued him because the song was He's So Fine that they claimed it was based upon. And when that went to court, the judge actually said, Harrison said, I really don't remember doing that, but the judge said, nevertheless, you're responsible for the contents of your unconscious memory.
Oh, so, that's interesting.
So you're culpable.
What do you think, Susan Bloom?
I that's actually very common in music. Coldplay was also accused of plagiarizing a song. I can't remember the source, actually, of one of their very popular songs. But musical melodies are apparently limited in number, or the number of chord progressions or something, so that it's very easy to imagine that you've invented some new melody. I agree with Kelly that there's a question of scale, and from what I've seen in the case of Rand Paul, it was clear that somebody, probably not him actually, I agree with that too, that somebody did lift whole paragraphs from sources. They couldn't have possibly done that by memory, I believe. But just like Fareed Zakaria, who was accused this past year of taking complicated information from New Yorker writer Jill Lepore, sometimes the material is complicated and it isn't very well digested. And so the claim is often made that people will go back and reintroduce quotation marks to make sure that they set off what somebody else's words and their own, and then that never happens. But I think it's unlikely that entire paragraphs or pages, sometimes it's several pages that are imported. It's unlikely that that's simply a case of memory, I would suspect.
Does that make sense to you, Alan Brown?
Yes, yes. And I think some of the instances of individuals who plagiarize large portions for their books, say, maybe they write notes, and they just don't annotate their notes well as they're reading through books and literature, and then they look at that, and then they absorb that as their own original notes rather than quotations from sources that they're reading in the library. So I think that's just sort of a failure to an accounting failure. They're not really taking accurate notes on what they're doing.
Right, and that's the digital problem that we have now. It used to be that before we had digital information, that you literally had to handwrite it down, and you were much more likely to synthesize or convert those notes. Now you're probably going to cut and paste. And I hear people who have been accused of plagiarism saying that all the time, and I go back over their notes, and if it really is a note problem, I'll work with them to develop a system where they know where their notes came from. There's even software that when you have cut and pasted something now that will annotate it for you. It will recognize that as a cut and paste. So it's not a very good excuse.
Alan Brown, I appreciate you joining us today in Radio Times, giving us something to think about. Thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
And he's a professor of psychology at Southern Methodist University, studies memory problems, and has studied something which he calls cryptomnesia, or perhaps inadvertent plagiarism. And we will continue our conversation with Kelly McBride. She's senior faculty in ethics reporting and writing at the Poynter Institute. And Susan Bloom is an anthropologist at the University of Notre Dame, wrote a book called My Word, Plagiarism and College Culture. The phones did explode at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Kelly, let me go back to you and just go back and talk about the difficulty when you're sifting through information, trying to write something original and perhaps even clever, something that I try to do every day. Mostly I fail at, but I read lots of information. I'm sifting through lots of information. Yesterday we did a show about the typhoon in the Philippines, and I'm reading the New York Times, and I'm reading the Washington Post and Reuters, and trying to sift through all this information and to write a fresh and original introduction. But I have to say, probably my introduction sounded like just about everybody else's. Is that plagiarism?
No, it just might be a lack of originality, because plagiarism really is the word for word copying. And the reason that your introduction sounded like everybody else's is words fail us when we try and describe something of the magnitude of what has happened in the Philippines. And there are some very gifted, talented writers that we all turn to try and do that for us. And then the rest of us who have to do exactly what you did yesterday, we just do our best.
And is that paraphrasing? I know there's something called patch writing, and perhaps you could talk about that, Kelly.
Yeah, patch writing is where you overly rely on your source material, and that is a phrase, to give credit here, that I learned from Rebecca Howard, who is a professor at Syracuse and has done a fair amount of research on plagiarism. And patch writing is where the writer has overly relied on source material, so you might see a list that looks exactly the same. same as the source material, or you might see a lot of phrases, dependent clauses, and that's a sign. If I'm a teacher, that's a sign for me that this student has not intellectually mastered the topic. If I'm a consumer, that's a sign that my source of information isn't working very hard.
So, Susan, just rearranging words or sentences or phrases, that's not good enough?
Well, that violates the letter of the law, which is basically to say you have to have your own ideas and your own words, which in some sense is impossible completely.
Right.
So all of us, even you, even I, we do rely on the work of others, and that's why Rebecca Moore Howard titled her book Acknowledging Standing on the Shoulders of Giants, because we all stand on others' shoulders. So your introduction, of course, relied on the work of all the other journalists who have done such excellent jobs reporting from the Philippines. Rebecca Moore Howard also claims, though, that novice writers rely on patch writing as a way of learning, and that instead of punishing that, we should work with it as they develop their skill and become more confident writers. Then they, after having digested the material, then they may be in a position to be able to come up with their own words. But often what we're asking of students is something that they really don't, they don't understand the ideas, they don't understand the format, they don't understand exactly what they're supposed to be doing. And so if we give them some tools and kind of scaffold their increase in knowledge, eventually they will be able to produce something that we would all agree is original. But to expect complete originality from very young writers is unrealistic.
Let me get some callers in on our conversation. Now, it looks like we have Austin from Egg Harbor Township in New Jersey. Austin, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I'm glad you mentioned the value of emulation, I guess, for novel or new writers. I had a conversation a few years ago with a professor of ethics at Oxford named Dan Robinson, and he's an Aristotle disciple, and he said strongly recommended emulating the greats in your writing and thought for years and years before, and because the brain automatically synthesizes, he says you'll get to a place of originality, but you know, first emulate, and make sure that you really appropriate for yourself the, you know, the best ideas and choose from among them, make sure that you engage with and understand them. So stepping back, I guess, what is the value of plagiarism in education, and how could the risks of that be managed?
Austin, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me toss that first to you, Kelly. Do you see emulation and plagiarism as the way Austin might?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And Susan gave an eloquent description of how we teach people to write. And really, when we're teaching people to write, we're teaching them to think. We're teaching them to express their thoughts. And it's commonly misunderstood. So yes, with a young writer, a novice, a young teenager, you are starting with these preconceived formats. And I mean, what one of us as a writer didn't sit down, didn't hear the advice that you sit down and you type out a page of Hemingway and then you try and emulate that style, right? That's a really common way of learning to write. And so, yes, do I expect my 13-year-old to emulate on her science project her source material? Absolutely. Do I expect my 19-year-old in college to be at the same level? No. I think that she has, that there's a different standard. And in a professional, I have a completely different expectation of.
How about for you, Susan, your expectations?
Oh, I agree. But I would also put college students in the novice category when we're talking about academic writing. Professionals are a completely different category, I would say. Those of us teaching undergraduates have forgotten often how we got to where we are with our mastery of all of these very peculiar forms of citation, attribution, footnotes. It's second nature to us, but it wasn't always. And we've, in some sense, erased all memory of the process of learning. And so, in some sense, we're expecting too much of our young writers. And undergraduates are often young, at least in terms of the styles of writing that we're expecting of them.
Well, and I actually think that as we've gone to assessment-based education, we've gotten away from some of the creative ways that we teach writing in education. And this is, I have no expertise in this. This is only my own experience as a mom and as somebody who has volunteered in the schools. I hear college professors complaining all the time about the level of writing that their students are capable of in the undergraduate world. And I think, you know, we don't let them write as much, and we don't let them take as many risks in high school because we expect them to be able to write an expository essay that they will be graded on in a state-based assessment test.
Let me see what Chris from... Go ahead, Susan.
Okay, I just wanted to say that there are some really brilliant and creative things being done in college writing these days, often by people in composition studies, in the study of rhetoric, in English departments. And so people are actually experimenting with things like having students write blogs or other kinds of new writing, which they're much more conversant with. And there's a professor at Stanford, Andrea Lunsford, who's done a study comparing the quality of writing on student blogs with the quality of writing on term papers. And they write more, they write better, and they write much more happily and more comfortably when it's something they consider to be more functional and useful than the old-fashioned kind of expository term papers that we were all raised on.
Kelly, let me ask you something before we have to take another break and get back to our callers, because you wonder about the brazenness of some people. I'm thinking of Jonah Lehrer, who made up quotes, for instance. Joe Biden, back in the day, lifted whole passages from Neil Kinnock. One wonders, when you're that sort of bold about your plagiarism, what you think you're getting away with, or why you think you could get away with that?
Well, that's a really complicated question. I think that what happens is you start with small forms of plagiarism and you get to big forms of plagiarism. I mean, Jason Blair is the classic example of that. And when we looked at everything that he had written, we found that you could go all the way back to his college writing and find examples of plagiarism. When I have been called in by newspaper editors to look at a particular case of plagiarism, I ask them to pull all of the writer's work for the last 5 years. Wow. And we look at that and we almost inevitably see a progression. And so I suspect that that when you have a major massive fraud like that, I think that every single time you will go back and you will find a progression of small and then increasingly larger instances of plagiarism that just weren't caught.
And that's Kelly McBride, senior faculty in ethics reporting and writing at the Poynter Institute. Also with us, Susan Bloom. She's a cultural and linguistic anthropologist at the University of Notre Dame. Wrote a book a couple of years ago called My Word, Plagiarism and College Culture. We will get back to your caller, calls, I should say, at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Recall the first time you met John Kennedy?
Yes, I do.
I told him, I said, Mr. Kennedy, he says, look, my name is Jack. You call me Jack.
And there he was, the President of the United States, standing on the doorstep.
I'm Robert McNeil, and the program is We Knew JFK, Unheard Stories from the Kennedy Archives, from the Public Radio Exchange.
God, I hope they don't play this for a long, long time.
Friday night at 10 on WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, Angelica Houston, who became famous for her roles in Pritzi's Honor and The Grifters, and more recently co-starred in Smash. Her new memoir is about her formative years. Her father was the celebrated director John Houston, but when she was a teenager and he directed her in a film, it scared her away from acting for a while and she became a model. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
70 years ago, that's how long since Abe Lincoln delivered the Gettysburg Address.
This is an ongoing experiment. We've got to keep renewing the promise of America from generation to generation.
Independent Senator Angus King on Gettysburg and whether a divided nation is still standing. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain talking with Susan Bloom and Kelly McBride about plagiarism. Let me get Chris from Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Chris, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I go to a local university, pretty well known. I don't want to say its name.
Okay.
But this is very closely related to cheating, because plagiarism is cheating. And, you know, I've seen students, you know, especially foreign exchange students, you know, they just cheat like it's second nature. And when you bring it up to the professor or the, you know, the TA, they kind of just brush it off and like they can't be bothered with it. And it's almost as if it would be too much work to expel these students than it would, you know, to deal with this. Is plagiarism, is this a cultural issue or is it an operational issue? Do professors have enough time to deal with this? Are they understaffed?
You raise a number of points. I don't know, Susan Bloom, as an anthropologist, is this a cultural issue, plagiarism, do you think?
Yes.
Yes?
The short answer is yes, it is a cultural issue, absolutely, because our norms of intellectual property, our norms of citation and attribution, the role of a student vis-a-vis authorities, is completely cultural. We have not always had that. In the Renaissance, it was considered blasphemy to consider anybody a creator other than God. Hmm. Only God could create. Humans could only imitate. So in the intervening years, we've had this idea that we are supposed to be original and we are supposed to be unique as individuals. Students growing up in other countries, and my own expertise is in the study of China, they undergraduates certainly would never dare to claim that they could produce anything original. They're task is to assemble authoritative sources and to present them because that's the right answer to the question. And so they come here and we expect them to follow our norms, and I would certainly expect them to follow them. It isn't to excuse their behavior, but to say that they have not been trained in a system that is as exacting as ours about the requirement to cite sources. And so when they come here, we have to work harder with students from almost every other society other than, let's say, Western Europe, to explain our norms, to explain the reasons behind our norms. And I have to say that many faculty in fields other than the humanities and the social sciences aren't themselves that familiar with the reasons behind these norms.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And so we need to work with them, and it is time-consuming. There's no question about it. And so there is that what you call operational problem as well, in that it isn't something we can just give them a handout for or send them to a website and hope that they understand it. But I would like to put in a plug for a website. It's called OWL. It's through Purdue, and they have a really fantastic website explaining how to avoid plagiarism. So when your TA is overworked, at least the TA could refer the students to that website. But many universities now are having special workshops for international students to try to deal with this problem.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Everywhere, as people from different cultural backgrounds interact.
Kelly, anything you want to add to that?
Well, just as our news media gets more global, you have more of a blending of different cultures in the world of publication, and so you know, we're paying attention to this.
Let me get looks like Cassandra. Thanks, Chris, for the call. Cassandra from Narberth, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
Thanks for doing this program.
Sure.
It's
you're
perfect
welcome.
Timing, actually, because I'm teaching first year composition at a local university, and I'm working with the students on two things that seem to revolutionize their writing. They're coming from the five-paragraph essay and sort of dumping data into their papers to a place where they're encountering the response, you know, about patch writing that they never knew existed, you know, that they didn't know was a phenomenon or a problem. Right. And also trying to teach them how to use I to really be alongside their sources in a research paper. And some of the responses have been, well, how do I do that and not look stupid? And so my response is to treat it like a conversation in which these people are supporting you, and, you know, you just have to make sure that the reader knows whose ideas are there, and when they shift, you know, between voices, you have to be present there as I. So there's some great scholarly articles on it, that, and we're using them. It's just that it's a real Herculean effort.
That's interesting.
To do, and to get them we're to using.
Well, let me toss that to Kelly McBride. I guess the idea of owning what you write and using yourself and even the I word.
There's a really fabulous book called They Say, I Say, and it teaches students mainly, and it's really written for the undergraduate college student to formulate an argument about anything and to acknowledge that this argument already exists, to advance the argument. And that's really what you're trying to do with students, is to get them to the point where they can do that. I is a great word. And at the same time, it can't all be your opinion, right? You're trying to get students to do fact-based work. And so I hear from other professors who are like, you know, I don't care what you think. I want to know what you know. And that's important, too. And so it really is the appropriate use of that word, I.
Thanks for the call, Cassandra. Let me see what looks like Bob from Downingtown has to say. Bob, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks for taking the call.
You're welcome.
I'm a 54-year-old change career guy with three daughters. Two are in college, and I'm in graphic design online, Arts Institute of Pittsburgh. And what I really love about my profession now and the training is the actual writing, the critiques. I find that it's so easy to be original, and yet I wonder, like, for my daughter's generation, like, you know, I'm obviously, you know, older, and I wonder if that's just because, you know, different going back to school adult, you know, finds it easier to be original, but it just seems like the things you mentioned are very helpful and needed to encourage, you know, how to be original, how to trust, you know, your thoughts about the context and then be factual. And obviously, you know, we have to substantiate what we do in design by a very technical process, and we have to, you know, kind of grid that out. But the creative thought, sure, brainstorm idea, you know, I wonder, you know, those things that you can put out there to encourage, you know, the younger generation to take confidence and not, you know, just go to the ease of, you know, all information is all over for them to just cut and paste.
Well, Bob, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Susan, let me toss that to you. And we've got an older student. Sounds like he's got, perhaps has the confidence he might have had as a younger student, the confidence of his ideas and his originality. Is that a factor, do you think?
It can be. I think also, though, he's probably more comfortable with the older forms of writing that we actually ask students to do in school. I'm interested, actually, in going back to what Cassandra was talking about, because students often come from high school with the idea that writing they do in school is supposed to have a certain kind of function and form. It's supposed to be gradable by people sitting in a room reading the SAT, or it's supposed to fit on some kind of template. So she mentioned the five-paragraph essay, which is basically a formula. And so you're supposed to make a claim and then support it and things like that. And so taking that training where there is none of themselves in there, it seems as if they're supposed to accomplish a certain kind of task, which is, I crank this in and I crank it out, and at the end of it, I get a grade. And so Bob is putting himself into it because he's looking at his education as something that matters to him for his own purposes, because he's going to use it immediately. A lot of our students see school as simply a matter of jumping through hoops.
Sure.
And so trying to introduce a kind of involvement and engagement on their own part and putting their own perspective on these school assignments that they have to, in their view, often crank out one after another, involves also reconsidering what we're asking students to do in school.
Fair enough. Bob, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Kelly, let me ask you about how you think things like information sharing and social media, where there is so much of sharing of images, pictures, ideas, how you think that affects people's ideas about originality, whether we think of authorship having more to do with a collective versus an individual.
Well, one of the things is I think it's much more common now that we see people's first drafts of writing, and that's all we ever see. We write so much now, and we publish so frequently that for the most part, when you're consuming information on social media or in your daily media, you're mostly seeing first drafts. And I think that those of us who write know that actually, if you want to be truly original, it takes 3, 4, 5, 7, 10, lots and lots of drafts. And so I wish that we would be able to harness the power of social media to create a refined culture of writing. And I don't mean refined snobby. I mean refined where we've actually fixed it and made it better. Because I see so much writing now that is clunky. And it's just because it wasn't refined. It wasn't edited.
Do you see clunky writing, Susan?
Oh, of course. And I probably have been guilty of clunky writing myself, I'm afraid. People are writing so much. I think that's actually one of the amazing things that the Internet has brought to the world, is that a quarter or something of all people now consider themselves a writer. People are writing novels. People are writing poetry. They're just writing and writing and writing, which I think is a magical development that all these people want to say things to the world. And for many people, they don't care if somebody else takes their material. The problem is sorting out when people want to share freely and when people don't, and all of it comes up as bites, digital bites. And so Wikipedia is kind of an example of people sharing freely, and they have their own rules where nothing is allowed to be original on Wikipedia. Everything has to have a source from somewhere else. And so people who are operating in the system are not quite as jealous, let's say, of what it is to be an author. It seems as if all of this material is just out there ready for the taking. But, of course, we're asking for something slower, more patient. Many drafts go into a wonderful book. You know, all the books that everybody's reading, the Booker Prize, the Pulitzer Prize, all those things, everything has been crafted carefully with the help of editors. And there are a lot of people who have to be paid for this really high-quality writing, which is different from a blogger writing something clunky. And so we're in this transitional moment that I don't think anybody has any guess as to how it's going to end.
Indeed. Let me see what looks like Yoni from Cherry Hill has to say. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I'm currently a master's student at Rowan, and I've discovered this transition as I'm now in a graduate level program, that in high school and college, there wasn't a discussion of engaging with the work. And as you guys are mentioning, putting eye into it, that you can have a discussion between originality of your work by working within and saying, I feel about this relating to your original sources, and that we've gotten so wrapped up with the SATs and things like that and creating the formatted based writing is we've forgotten to teach students how it is to be engaged with writing, and then forces them to be like, okay, I have to fit myself into A, B, or C, and that then says, oh, in order for me to do that, I have to plagiarize.
Yeah.
And that versus using like MLA or APA and learning how to use these formats of helping you cite your sources is being left out of that education.
Okay, fair enough. Yoni, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Kelly or Susan, any comment to what Yoni just said?
Well, the one thing that I would... Yeah, this is Kelly. The one thing that I would say is... you know, yeah, he's in graduate school, which means he is specializing in something now. And the expectations of his audience are that eventually he will become an expert in whatever he is studying. So he might be in graduate school for literature. And his expectations and his audience's expectations are going to be for his writing to be to be at a level that it expresses some originality. Whereas my 17-year-old, you know, who last night had to write a character analysis of Beowulf and Grendel, you know.
I remember those days, yes.
Right. That the expectations for him are just do your best, right? Just turn your brain on and look at this and do the analysis. And we don't expect my 17-year-old to say anything brilliant about Beowulf or Grendel. But if he's a graduate student in literature, we're expecting him to get there, you know? And the other thing is that even for those of us who are expected to do original writing, we don't always get there. We fall short. I would say I fall short about half the time.
And that's because, I mean, Susan, we're almost out of time here, but Susan was talking about, you know, great literature that takes time. And I think, you know, as a journalist, Kelly, you it often feels like there isn't time.
Right, yeah.
We're going to end
and
on
our
that.
Students certainly are pressed for time. But in response to Yoni's comment, I think it also depends on the field of study, because right. In the field of anthropology, we are expected to draw on our own experience, but not just for the sake of indulging in a story. There's a kind of sophisticated art in using one's own experience and viewpoint to come up with a broader point, but that takes a kind of sophistication.
Indeed. Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you. Susan Bloom, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And Kelly McBride, thank you very much as well.
You're welcome.
And go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can learn much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. Thanks so much for joining us.